Similarly, in India, not hundreds but millions of us would be ashamed and offended if we were in any way implicated with the present Indian government's fascist policies, which, apart from the perpetration of state terrorism in the Valley of Kashmir in the name of fighting terrorism, have also turned a blind eye to the recent state-supervised pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat. It would be absurd to think that those who criticize the Indian government are anti-Indian, although the government itself never hesitates to take that line. It is dangerous to cede to the Indian government or the American government or anyone for that matter the right to define what India or America are or ought to be. To call someone anti-American, indeed to be anti-American, or for that matter, anti-Indian or anti-Timbuktuan, is not just racist, it's a failure of the imagination. An inability to see the world in terms other than those the establishment has set out for you. If you're not a Bushi, you're a Taliban. If you don't love us, you hate us. If you're not good, you're evil. If you're not with us, you're with the terrorists.
And that was Arundhati Roy in a talk she gave with Howard Zinn that was all recorded. And that track was called The World in Other Terms. And that track comes off the album Come September in conversation with Howard Zinn. Greetings and welcome to Bernie 2020. This is an independent podcast on progressive politics inspired by Bernie Sanders, progressive and radical activism, and the Green Party. This podcast is completely independent of any candidate, party, PAC, or political organization. If you want to reach out to me, you can send me a message at BernieUS2020@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at BernieUS2020. Find out more about Bernie 2020 at Bernie-2020.com. There you'll find all the back episodes. You can even go back to Bernie 2016 and listen to all those episodes as well. You'll also find some links there to make a donation. You can make a one-time or recurring donation to keep Bernie 2020 independent. So Getting Started is a piece from Bernie Sanders. This piece was written by Bernie Sanders, published in the Houston Chronicle at HoustonChronicle.com. When President Trump meets with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Houston, we will hear much about the friendship between the American and Indian peoples. However, there will be a deafening silence when it comes to a human rights crisis unfolding right before our eyes. And that is unacceptable. The Modi-Trump rally is happening at a moment when the state of Kashmir remains under lockdown. In early August, Modi's government unilaterally revoked Kashmir's long-standing autonomy, has cracked down on dissent, jailed political leaders, and instituted a communications blackout. The lockdown has also blocked Kashmiris' access to basic medical care. In a letter in the British Medical Journal on August 16, a group of doctors from across India asked their government to ease restrictions on communication and travel, saying they were, quote, a blatant denial of the right to health care and the right to life, because they made it difficult for patients and staff to get to hospitals. A recent Human Rights Watch report notes that, quote, from chemotherapy to dialysis, patients are struggling to access life-saving treatment on time. President Trump has voiced no criticism of these troubling moves. He should be demanding that these restrictions be lifted and communications be restored immediately. To be clear, Pakistan has also often played a bad role in Kashmir, but I believe the U.S. president must speak clearly in support of international humanitarian law and in support of a UN-backed peaceful resolution between India and Pakistan that respects the will of the Kashmiri people. Unfortunately, Trump has chosen to abandon the United States' global leadership role. He is remaining silent on the Kashmir crisis while planning to hold a public rally with India's prime minister. Trump's silence in the face of India's Kashmir crackdown is consistent with his broader failure to speak up for human rights across the world. It is no secret that I disagree with President Trump on virtually every major policy issue today. I believe that health care is a human right and should be available to all, regardless of income. He wanted to throw 32 million off the health care they had. I believe that at a time of massive income and wealth inequality, the wealthy and large profitable corporations should begin paying their fair share of taxes. He provided huge tax breaks to billionaires like himself. On and on it goes. But as I have said many times, what disturbs me most about Trump is not just his reactionary views on economic issues, but also his unprecedented effort to divide the American people based on the color of our skin, our religion, our country of origin, and our sexual orientation. Not only is his demagoguery tearing our country apart, indeed, in recent years, we have seen a significant increase in hate crimes, white nationalism, and overt acts of racism. But other autocratic, intolerant leaders around the world find affirmation in it. All over the world, we have witnessed the rise of intolerant, authoritarian political leaders who are attacking the very foundations of democratic societies. In an age of massive global wealth inequality and economic anxiety, these demagogues exploit people's pain and fears by amplifying resentments, stoking intolerance, and fanning ethnic and racial hatreds to maintain power. Instead of holding the wealthy and powerful accountable, they scapegoat the weak and the powerless. Unlike our current president, who has an apparent affection for authoritarian regimes, I will make the promotion of democracy and human rights a priority for the United States. I know that when a president stays silent in the face of religious persecution, repression, and brutality, the dangerous message this sends to autocratic leaders around the world is, go ahead, you can get away with it. As president, I will forcefully combat racism and hatred because I know our nation's diversity is a manifestation of our strength, not a weakness. Together, we will end the discrimination and divisiveness and bring our nation together based on the principles of justice, compassion, and tolerance. The issue of hatred and prejudice is personal for me. I am the proud son of Jewish immigrants. My father came from Poland to the United States at age of 17 to escape poverty and widespread anti-Semitism. The Nazis murdered the members of his family who remained in Poland after Hitler came to power. My own family story taught me at an early age about the importance of standing against prejudice and discrimination wherever we see it. When we defeat Trump, this kind of destructive behavior in the White House will end. And here's a piece from Vice.com written by Emma Aukerman. Here's AOC's massive plan to address poverty in America. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just unveiled another ambitious policy package, this one geared towards lifting more Americans out of poverty. At a time when other buzzy proposals like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal are becoming something of a litmus test for progressives, for progressive 2020 Democrats. Quote, one of the things that we can get done is build popular support in acknowledging how bad the problem already is. In doing so, we can actually begin to fundamentally address those problems, the 29-year-old freshman Democrat from New York told NPR before the package was officially revealed Wednesday. Ocasio-Cortez, a bogeyman of the right, has introduced or endorsed many of the policies that are now key to progressive candidates' platforms. AOC's new six-bill proposal, dubbed A Just Society, would first update the way in which the U.S. calculates poverty and determines eligibility for welfare, an equation that currently shuts out many struggling Americans. Right now, a single person is considered poor in the U.S. if they make less than $12,500 a year. In some instances, making more than that amount means losing out on programs like Medicaid. Ocasio-Cortez's proposal would take that old equation and factor in things like a person's geographic cost of living, what portion of their income they spend on health insurance or child care, and spending towards utilities like internet access. Those inclusions would raise the federal poverty level and widen Americans' eligibility to welfare programs. The rest of the policy bundle includes proposals that would then lift Americans out of poverty by expanding welfare access or by offering worker and rental protections that keep people from being exploited. It would cap rent increases, increase access to Medicaid, the government's health care program for the poor. Here's what else the Just Society package includes. One bill would cap annual rent increases at 3%, while also widening tenants' rights to prevent unjust evictions. The bill would also create grants to fund legal representation for low-income tenants, too, a policy that has already led to fewer evictions in some cities. It would also prevent landlords from discriminating against potential tenants based on where they get their income. New legislation would decrease highway funding to jurisdictions that don't support equitable housing developments as a means to influence changes on restrictive local zoning laws. Two bills would keep the government from denying welfare benefits to Americans based on their either past criminal history or their immigration status. One bill, the Uplift Workers Act, would create a new worker friendliness score for federal contractors so the U.S. can avoid funding jobs that don't offer paid overtime for those who work more than 40 hours per week, a living wage, or paid leave. The plan also asks the U.S. to join the 170 nations that have already agreed to ratify the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, a United Nations treaty. Right now, Americans are facing staggering wealth inequality, sluggish wage growth, and a rising cost of living thanks to increased rents and health care costs. Yet, in part because the U.S. poverty rate has ticked down slightly, critical welfare programs from Medicaid to affordable housing to food assistance have faced severe cuts from the Trump administration. Nearly 40 million people in the U.S. live in poverty. Of course, these proposals, much like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All bills, face an unlikely future in Congress. The Senate is controlled by Republicans, and moderate Democrats have stonewalled progressive legislation in the House. But also, much like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All bills, 2020 candidates will be forced to choose whether they're with progressive Democrats like Ocasio-Cortez or comfortable with a more moderate image. And this next piece is written by the staff of the U.S. Peace Prize, published on popularresistance.org. We are pleased to announce that the 2019 U.S. Peace Prize has been awarded to the Honorable Ajamu Baraka, quote, whose bold anti-war actions, writings, speeches, and leadership provide an inspiring voice against militarism. Michael Knox, chair of the foundation, presented the award during a forum on September 23 in New York City. In his remarks, Knox said, quote, thank you, Ajamu, for your outstanding domestic and international activism to end wars and militarism. We applaud your long and distinguished record of working for social justice, human rights, civil rights, and peace. Many anti-war organizations have benefited from your innovative leadership and consultation. You are a force in revitalizing the Black anti-war tradition. I believe that Black Alliance for Peace could be the most important new anti-war organization established in this century. We want you to know that your efforts are greatly appreciated here and around the world. Thank you for your service. In his acceptance, Ajamu said, quote, I want to thank the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, Dr. Michael Knox, and the Board of Directors for this great honor and for your faith in me and my work. I accept this award this evening with great honor and humility. I accept not as an individual, but as a member of a collective of peace and anti-war activists, many of whom are in this room tonight, who paved the way with their sacrifice, courage, and unwavering dedication to the idea that we can live in a world without war. We envision a world where human beings can be free to live liberated from brutality, the madness of state and non-state violence in all forms, from direct military engagements to the war of sanctions. We believe that there is, in fact, an alternative to the irrationality that we call modernity, built on conquest, slavery, economic exploitation, and ongoing colonial domination. So I accept this on behalf of those visionaries, on behalf of the Black Alliance for Peace, and on behalf of all those who are committed to peace, but who understand that there can be no peace without justice. And for justice, we have to struggle to achieve it. In addition to receiving the U.S. Peace Prize, our highest honor, Mr. Baraka has been designated a founding member of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. He joins previous U.S. Peace Prize recipients, David Swanson, Anne Wright, Veterans for Peace, Kathy Kelly, Code Pink, Women for Peace, Chelsea Manning, Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, Dennis Kucinich, and Cindy Sheehan. The U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation directs a nationwide effort to honor Americans who stand for peace by publishing the U.S. Peace Registry, awarding the annual U.S. Peace Prize, and planning for the U.S. Peace Memorial in Washington, D.C. We celebrate these role models to inspire other Americans to speak out against war and work for peace. Ajamu Baraka, in addition to all of those things mentioned here, was the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party in the 2016 election. You probably remember the name Jill Stein. You may or may not remember the name Ajamu Baraka, who was her running mate. And I came across this tweet a couple weeks ago and just thought, wow, this is awesome. So I wanted to share it with you. This is tweeted by Elfe, who is at Lisa Fay, F-E-A-Y, on Twitter. To the person who uses metal straws to save fish, but consumes animals, I'd like to say thank you. To the vegan who isn't aware of our homeless problem, thank you. To the climate change activists who aren't attentive to fast fashion, thank you. To the girl who gives her old clothes to the disadvantaged but isn't educated on sex trafficking, thank you. To the guy who picks up rubbish on his way home from a surf but isn't well informed about male suicide rates, thank you. To the people who stand up for horse racing concerns but are uninformed of the cruelty of the dairy industry, thank you. To the positive Instagram influencer who hasn't cultivated a plastic-free lifestyle, thank you. To the grandparents who knit for sick children but aren't up to date with current race and homophobic issues, thank you. To the students who stand up for bullying but are unaware of the constant domestic violence epidemic, thank you. To the peace activists, feminists, stray dog adopters, teachers, volunteers, foster carers, recyclers, givers, doers, and believers, I say thank you. We are all on a different path, and we all see through different eyes. Current world issues that you are passionate about aren't always what other people are trying to change. and that's okay. It's not everyone's job to save every part of the world, but it is everyone's responsibility to thank every person who is doing their part to save the world. Don't critique, just appreciate. Don't judge, just educate. We are all trying our best. Thank you. And this next piece is published by Boing Boing at boingboing.net. And initially written, I believe, by Roy Poses, or based on a story by Roy Poses. Even if you're insured, and even if you assiduously verify that the emergency rooms you visit when undergoing a medical crisis are, quote, in network for your insurer, you can still end up with thousands of dollars in, quote, surprise bills from ER docs and anesthetists who don't work for the hospital. Instead, they work for private physician staffing firms who can and do charge whatever they want for your care. This started as a simple outsourcing exercise in which, quote, physician groups were contracted to provide services to hospitals. But then giant hedge funds and private equity groups started buying up these groups and jacking up prices by 86 to 91% in just a few years. And prices are still rising. The private equity looters focused on emergency care because, apart from prisons, it's the ultimate captive market. Once the ambulance drops you off mid-cardiac arrest at an in-network hospital, are you really going to ask to be taken somewhere else once you learn that the doc who triages you works for Blackstone or KKR and plans on billing you thousands of dollars over and above the tens of thousands of dollars your insurer will have to pay? These shenanigans might just be the last gasp of price-gouging, murderous American privatized healthcare, with optics so bad that they make the case for Medicare for All without any pushing from the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. What's a poor billionaire to do in the face of such public unwillingness to enter medical bankruptcy in order to enhance the fortunes of the global looter class? The answer is obvious. Found a dark money advocacy organization and spend millions on ads calling the anti-surprise billing movement, quote, socialist, and the proposed rules banning the practice, government rate setting, and showing ambulance crews trying to deliver their patients to dark emergency rooms whose staffs have all gone home because they can't ruin your finances while saving your life. $28 million later, we finally know who is behind Dr. Patient Unity, the dark money org who pushed these risible, dank memes. Team Health, part of Blackstone, the largest private equity fund in the world, and Envision Healthcare, part of private equity giant KKR. It took a lot of sleuthing. Dr. Patient Unity's true owners are hidden behind numbered companies, generic officers, and a code of silence. But once the New York Times had the incontrovertible evidence, Blackstone and KKR admitted that they were the funders. I'm sure that they'll be the first to tell you that they only kept their funding a secret because they knew you'd be delighted by the fact and they didn't want to spoil the surprise. Quote, we have long been concerned about how healthcare has been increasingly commercialized as hospitals and other provider organizations get bought out by for-profit corporations, and as physicians are increasingly employed by such corporations to provide care to individual patients, becoming corporate physicians. Even more concerning is the intervention of private equity. We first discussed the perils of private equity takeovers of hospitals here in 2010 and of physicians providing direct patient care as employees of corporations owned by private equity here in 2011. The private equity business model seems particularly unsuitable for organizations which provide patient care, as we discussed in some detail in 2012. For a quick modern summary of why it is bad to have private equity involved in direct patient care, see Merrill Guzner writing in Modern Healthcare, September 5, 2019. Quote, the private equity business model in healthcare parallels other industries, use highly leveraged private capital to roll up a number of small firms into one entity, with the private equity firm providing collective management. In addition to hefty fees for arranging the transaction, generally 1 to 2% of the purchase price, the private equity firm typically demands a 20% return on its investment after paying interest on the debt. After 3 to 7 years, assuming all goes well in achieving the promised efficiencies, the private equity firm and its junior partners earn a windfall by taking the company public or flipping it to another set of private equity investors. If things don't work out as planned, the firm cuts its losses and declares bankruptcy, with most of its capital being recouped through the 20% annual returns. The management company has two paths to achieve its financial targets, can either reduce costs sharply or look for ways to increase revenue. And next up is an excerpt from a study called Exponential Roadmap, Scaling 36 Solutions to Halve Emissions by 2030. And you can find the entire Exponential Roadmap at exponentialroadmap.org. Here is the executive summary. The 2019 Exponential Roadmap focuses on moving from incremental to exponential climate action in the next decade. It presents 36 economically viable solutions to cut global greenhouse gas emissions 50% by 2030 and the strategies to scale this transformation. The roadmap is consistent with the Paris Agreement's goal to keep global average temperature well below 2 degrees Celsius and aiming for 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The 2019 roadmap is the second in the series. Each new roadmap updates solutions that have proven potential to scale and charts progress towards exponential scaling. The roadmap, based on the Carbon Law, is a collaboration between academia, business, and civil society. And here is some detail about the Carbon Law, the Carbon Law pathway. We need moonshot thinking and exponential strategies inspired by Moore's Law to reach the Paris Agreement's ambitious goal. The Carbon Law trajectory, first proposed in 2017, is consistent with the UN agreement and the limited remaining carbon budget. Emissions peak by 2020. Emissions fall about 50% by 2030, then a further 50% by 2040, and a further 50% by 2050. Agriculture transforms from a carbon source to a carbon sink. Solutions to store carbon, for example, reforestation, biochar, or bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, are scaled up. Remaining natural carbon sinks are protected and enhanced. The roadmap is complemented with a high ambition narrative, meeting the 1.5 degree Celsius ambition that presents the case why holding global average temperature increase to just 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels is important. Since the first roadmap, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published its special report on 1.5 degrees centigrade. The report concluded that the economic and humanitarian risks of a 2-degree world are significantly higher than a 1.5 degree. The remaining emissions budget for 1.5 degrees is small and will be exceeded within 10 to 15 years at current emissions rates. The window of feasibility is closing rapidly. The global economic benefit of a low-carbon future is estimated at US $26 trillion by 2030, compared with staying on the current high-carbon pathway. The scale of transformation, halving emissions by 2030, is unprecedented, but the speed is not. Some cities and companies can transform significantly faster. Developed nations with significant historic emissions have a responsibility to reduce emissions faster. Greenhouse gas emissions and the solutions to reduce them are grouped by six sectors: energy, industry, transport, buildings, food consumption, nature-based solutions. Meeting the 1.5 degree goal means implementing solutions in parallel across all sectors. The solutions must scale exponentially. The roadmap identifies four levers required to scale the transformation, as well as necessary actions for each policy. For each: policy, climate leadership and movements, finance, and exponential technology. Implementation must be fair and just, or risk deep resistance. Transforming sectors, energy transformation. Any further investment in new carbon dioxide emitting energy systems is not consistent with the remaining carbon budget for 1.5 degree global warming. In 2018, renewable energy accounted for almost 2/3 of new installations for electricity generation. Solar and wind energy accounted for 84% of this growth. The world has reached a tipping point in price and performance for wind and solar power. In many places, wind and solar are cheaper than fossil fuel alternatives. The assumption that global energy demand will keep rising should be questioned. Global energy demand has the potential to fall 40% without sacrificing services and quality of life, according to new energy scenarios. These scenarios bring the ambitious goal of halving emissions by 2030 within reach. Not hindering the current exponential trajectories for wind, solar photovoltaics, and battery storage will be enough to achieve a halving of emissions by 2030. In less developed markets, however, support is still needed to reach a point where solar and wind energy can be supplied at lower costs than fossil fuels. Policies to remove obstacles and ensure a rapid and smooth transition from fossil to renewable energy include immediate removal of subsidies from fossil fuel-based power plants and infrastructure, introducing carbon pricing, and minimizing the social and economic impact on individuals who lose out in the transition. With the right policies and financing, many cities could achieve an electric grid mix of 50 to 70% renewables, primarily solar and wind, balanced with other zero emissions generation sources by 2030. Investment and research in new zero-carbon energy storage and generation technologies such as wave power must be sustained to achieve the reductions necessary beyond 2030. Transport. Shorter trips are responsible for 3/4 of transport emissions. Taking these emissions to around zero is economically viable and brings many co-benefits from healthy lifestyles to less polluted cities. Electrical and plug-in hybrid passenger vehicles can reach close to 100% of new sales by 2030 if they continue on high current exponential growth curves, even if growth slows from today's growth of 50% per year to 32%. This shift towards 100% of light vehicle sales to electric vehicles is the biggest immediate opportunity to dramatically reduce emissions in the transport sector. The snowball has started rolling in the last few years, with many major economies and cities announcing incoming bans on new fossil-fueled light-duty vehicles, as well as corporates committing to 100% electric vehicles. Mass transit, micromobility, cycling or scooters, and walking to avoid unnecessary car use is the other major opportunity to dramatically reduce emissions in the transport sector by 2030. A strong move to a usership instead of ownership model for cars can untap more value from cars, which are unused 95% of the time. Such a car fleet could be just 3% of the size of today's fleet of individually owned vehicles. Digital technology can cut business flights by 50% or more. Local co-working hubs can reduce commuting emissions by around 50 to 60% annually for many people. Heavy transportation can be optimized, retrofitted, electrified, and use renewable fuels, enabling a fast halving of emissions. Long-haul transport requires ambitious technology roadmaps. Halving emissions from shipping is technically feasible and economically viable with the right policy incentives and collaboration across the maritime industry and stakeholders. Industry. In most places, energy and emissions efficiency standards are too weak. Stronger policies can drive dramatically higher material efficiency, particularly with steel, cement, plastics, and aluminum production. Decarbonization of high emissions materials might not add more than a few percent in cost to end users. An increase in near-term R&D investment in those industries will be vital to enable the decarbonization required for the second and third halvings. Develop and scale the infrastructure required for the circular economy and accelerate reuse of materials through refunding schemes, increase scrap collection, and recycling rates. All manufacturing businesses and industries should set ambitious targets to aim to have emissions by the latest 2030, and there is a need to develop industry roadmaps across all sectors and value chains aligned with the 1.5 degree, creating a race to the top between companies. Physical retailers and e-commerce platforms should be developing strategies to incentivize low emissions products, recycling, and longer product lifetimes. Digitalization is a key enabler to increase energy and material efficiencies and enable circular economy and usership based on business models. The Internet of Things allows greater traceability of materials and products, while artificial intelligence can optimize processes for efficiency. Industrial design, engineering, and architecture should increasingly adopt low emissions options as default. Buildings. For countries, cities, and companies, strong policies and programs to have carbon emissions in existing building stock are necessary. These solutions must scale rapidly. New procurement practices for construction and renovation are required. These should require dramatically improved energy and carbon emission standards. A critical mass of companies in the construction and facilities management industries must become true climate leaders, driving emissions cuts through value chains and setting an example for others to follow. New low-carbon business models for sharing space and smart buildings must scale globally to achieve economies of scale. Businesses must be open to new economic models to take advantage of the sharing of space. Funding should be allocated for sustainable retrofitting and construction, perhaps through the use of green bonds. Solutions in this sector should be standardized and scalable around the world, rather than dispersed and fragmented, to achieve results. Food consumption. A rapid shift towards reduced meat consumption and reduced food waste are essential components of a systemic strategy to keep global warming well below 2 degrees. This will be accelerated through removal of subsidies, promoting unsustainable and unhealthy food production and consumption, and new incentives for healthy and sustainable practices and behavior. Carbon pricing and supportive emission standards for the food system. National dietary guidelines promoting healthy and sustainable eating and policies enacted to make healthy food affordable and accessible to everyone. Regulatory measures in place to drastically reduce the food loss and waste. Nature-based solutions. In 2018-2019, several major academic assessments on food system transformation were published. For example, the EAT Lancet Commission on Healthy Diets from Sustainable Food Systems. These findings are now included in the roadmap. For these reasons, the 2019 roadmap expands on nature-based solutions, for example, reforestation and peatland management to create new carbon sinks. Nature-based solutions from forest protection, grazing management, and fertilizer management can have emissions by 2030, while reforestation, biochar, and improved agricultural practices have the potential to store up to 9.1 billion tons of CO2 annually, eventually storing 225 billion tons by the end of the century. And there is a lot more in this report, lots and lots more details. Those were really the kind of overview bullet points of what is in this report. Once again, this report is the Exponential Roadmap, Scaling 36 Solutions to Halve Emissions by 2030. And finally, a piece by Emily Kirkland. This is published by CommonDreams.org. Senator Bernie Sanders is not just one man. He is a movement. What he represents is a set of ideals that will pull this nation out of the soul-sucking quicksand in which we currently find ourselves. After the news of the senator's recent health setbacks, many people are worried about the future of the Sanders campaign. I was one of them. I found myself thinking, quote, will the voters' confidence be shaken? Will the people vote for someone who may not be able to weather the stress of the presidency? How can we keep asking him to sacrifice his health for the good of the nation? I wasn't sure. I'm still not. My father had a heart attack, stents, and more a few years back. I can't honestly say that I would want my dad to put himself through such grueling work. I want him for myself, and I want to make each moment we have last as long as possible. These should be happy days of enjoying life's simple pleasures and each other's company. Can I really ask so much of someone when I'm not willing to give it up myself? So I spent some moments in introspection, imagining the various scenarios and what-ifs of a future without Bernie. They all seemed a bit lackluster. But I thought, maybe it's time. He has already given the Democratic Party and this country so much. The issues at the forefront today, like healthcare and student debt, are so dramatically different from what they were 4 years ago. And we have Senator Sanders to thank for that. Without his voice representing the millions of disenfranchised voters across this land, we would still be in that sandpit, slowly sinking to the bottom. He has thrown us a lifeline. We can't let that go. Is it time for him to hand the rope to someone else to struggle onward, to let the man rest and enjoy life with his family? But who could take on the struggle? Is any single person up to the task? Perhaps not. But then I realized that isn't really the point of Bernie's campaign. Not me, us. Not one single person, but all of us pulling together. This movement is so much bigger than one person. The movement does not begin and end with Sanders. From the first day he steps into the Oval Office, the change begins like a pebble thrown into the water, reverberating through the depths, rippling across the surface. Every individual within his administration will be a part of the revolution. Every person who chooses to stand at his side represents the ideals of integrity, honesty, humility, transparency, and responsibility to our environment, responsibility to those who are voiceless. The reason people support Bernie Sanders is not because of the man. It is because of the ideals that he represents. He fights for the issues that are dear to us, and people trust him to fill his administration with those who will carry on in these fights. I have no doubt that his administration will be one of moral integrity, that every person appointed and hired will have these ideals at heart and will have the moral fortitude to stand up to corporate interests and lobbyists. A government for the people and by the people. And while I would love for Sanders to fill the role of president for 4 whole years, we would be blessed to have even one day, because that is all we truly need. For just a moment, someone to put their foot in the door so the rest of us can gather the strength to get out of this sandpit, push open that door more fully, and allow in the integrity and compassion we've been missing. Ultimately, the choice is his, but knowing Bernie, I believe that he'll be fighting with every bit of his strength until his final days, may they be many years from now. Win or lose, rain or shine, because that is simply the type of person he is. So, as selfish as it may be, I ask that he keep fighting for us just a little longer. I am willing to put my faith in the movement as a whole. I am putting my faith in every person that is part of this. Keep pulling. Not me. Us. And of course, Bernie Sanders isn't in this alone. And Bernie Sanders knows if he was in this alone that he would fail. And that is why his campaign message this time around is not me. Us. We need to all be Bernie Sanders. We need to all be Greta Thunberg. We need to all be AOC. We need to all be Harriet Tubman. We need to all be Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and everyone who spends their life and dedicates their time and their efforts to making the world better, a better place for all of us. So as these individuals whose names we know rise and recede, that there are many, many of us inspired by them, supporting what they supported, encapsulating those ideals within ourselves, and rising up ourselves to fill those spaces in, fill in those gaps. Ryan Harvey has a song. It's called Ordinary Heroes. And in it, he sings, we need many Harriet Tubmans, and we need many Howard Zinns. Ordinary heroes. And that's what we need. We all need to be Bernie, to carry on this work alongside Bernie for as long as Bernie's here to help with that work. And as Bernie becomes less able, then others need to step in and step up to fill in the gap. That'll wrap up this episode of Bernie 2020. Remember, you can send me an email at BernieUS2020@gmail.com. You can follow on Twitter at BernieUS2020. And you can check out all the back episodes at Bernie-2020.com. Can also watch and listen to me record Bernie 2020 live on twitch.tv/unrelatedthings. Here is Ryan Harvey with Ordinary Heroes. Thanks for listening.
Standing on the shoulders of people who sat and stood and fought. and sacrifice their lives and time so that we'd be better off. I'm talking about ordinary people whose courage held them through. We need many Harriet Tubmans, and we need many Sojourner Truths, ordinary heroes. And the mines in Trinidad grew a spirit of justice that spread across the nation and lit a fire that burned so bright that it still brings people hope. We need many Cesar Chavez's and we need many Mother Jones's, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary. Mystical twist of luck. They're the fruits of people sweating and stressing and never giving up. It takes a lot of hard work and commitment to lift every voice and sing. We need many Ella Bakers and we need many Martin Luther Kings, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes. Standing on the shoulders of people who put a lot of hard work in and passed along their trials and errors to future generations. And the stories that we pass along will be the thing that keeps us in. We need many Woody Guthries and we need many Howard Zinns, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes, ordinary heroes.